Revelation chapter 13. Chapter 12, you might recall, was the woman and the dragon. You've got Satan going after Israel, who gives birth to Messiah and to the church. You've got chapter 13, you've got two beasts. The first beast, we've already discussed quite a bit, the first beast is an image of Rome. It rises out of the sea, coming from the west, 10 horns, 7 heads, an image of a political power, ready to crush and do evil. The second beast is what we're focusing on right now, even though it might not seem like it sometimes. We are. Second beast, and let's read in verse, starting in verse 11. I'll do the reading. Then I saw another beast rising out of the earth. It had 2 horns like a lamb, and it spoke like a dragon. It exercises all the authority of the first beast in its presence. It makes the earth and its inhabitants worship the first beast, whose mortal wound was healed. It performs great signs, even making fire come down from heaven to earth in front of people. And by the signs that it is allowed to work in the presence of the beast, it deceives those who dwell on the earth, telling them to make an image for the beast that was wounded by the sword and yet lived. And it was allowed to give breath to the image of the beast, so that the image of the beast might even speak and might cause those who would not worship the image of the beast to be slain. And it causes all, both small and great, both rich and poor, both free and slave, to be marked on the right hand or the forehead, so that no one can buy or sell unless he has the mark, that is, the name of the beast or the number of its name. This calls for wisdom. Let the one who has understanding calculate the number of the beast, the first beast. For it is the number of a man, and his number is 666. All right? So the second beast, if you just think generically, what are these images trying to point to? The second beast is a political entity. All right? Just like the first beast. The first beast is a political entity. The second beast is a political entity. First beast has 10 horns and 7 heads. The second beast has only 2 horns. It is significantly less powerful than the first beast. But that's okay. They're not fighting. The first beast and the second beast are in perfect alignment. All right? The first beast is the main beast. Of course, not really. I mean, the first beast really points towards the real beast, the dragon, in chapter 12. But this first beast is an image of the dragon. Well, the second beast is sitting there pointing towards the first beast, trying to get people to obey the first beast. The first beast, of course, being Rome. The second beast, which is part of the question, is who is the second beast? All right. Now, my general contention, all right, and why we've been doing some of what we've been doing, is that the second beast represents, if the first beast represents Rome, the second beast represents the Herodian dynasty and Israel as a whole. All right, not necessarily all the individual members of Israel. Because the Herodians, and that's part of why we'll be going through the history today, the purpose of the Herodians was to always make peace with Rome. The Herods loved Rome. If the Herods would ever disagree with Rome, it was always for Rome's benefit, all right? Not for the people's benefit, all right? We'll see that as we go through. So this beast has political power, as the Herods had. They had quite a bit. Herod himself was king. Those who were his children and ancestors were, you know, given various different roles, but all in, well, you know, in positions of authority within Israel. They also had spiritual power. Why? Because they chose the high priests. All right, they got to choose who was in charge when it comes to spiritual things. And you can see, as a part of this, right, both the political but spiritual aspect. Revelation, a lot of it focuses on more of the spiritual aspect. Because after this, Revelation no longer calls it primarily the second beast. Revelation starts calling this beast the false prophet. And you can see this in the images of Elijah, who calls down fire from heaven. Well, this is not Elijah. This is a false Elijah. All right. In the images of the law on the hands and the forehead, well, instead of obedience to God, it's more obedience to Caesar is more important to the second beast. All right, so that's generally where we're going. Yes. Think of it, I don't want to say it's just the Herods, those individual people, but it's the Herods and those that, it's generally the people of the land and the Herods. It's the Jewish nation as a whole, but not in all particulars. Like, for example, the Christians, for example, would not be included in that group. All of those, like the Herodians, a group that's mentioned in the New Testament, would certainly be included in that. And all of the Pharisees and Sadducees that participated with them, sometimes peacefully, sometimes not, sometimes peacefully with the Herods in the rule of Caesar in the land. There are other options. When we get through this, I'll miss some other options for you, because it's not like that's the only opinion in the world. Okay, so you have two things. One, you have the Herodians in Rome. This is what we're going to be going through today. This is a corrected version, all right, of last time with some new stuff. Some minor things like dates got added, new references to material. Some very important things like I misspelled assassinated twice. Fix that. So that's front and back. This other piece of paper, okay. There is a family tree. This is not the entire family tree of Herod. Herod had 10 wives and more children than this. So there are more offspring. But these are the only ones that are going to be relevant to us in our discussion. Also, there's this long selection from a book called 2 Esdras. Esdras is just the Greek name of Ezra. You will find this in many copies of the so-called Apocrypha. And so this, for example, would be, this is not accepted at all, I don't believe, by the Eastern Orthodox in this case, but is by, to a certain degree, by the Catholics. And Protestants have found it useful. Apparently, Christopher Columbus also referenced 2 Esdras in his argument for going across the Atlantic to come to America. It's been around and has been influential in history. There's a selection here, which we won't have time to read through, I fully expect. I'll just give you the synopsis version of it really quickly. This is for you to read. You can find this online, no problem. Or if you have a copy of the Apocrypha, there's a good chance it's in there. Basically, the idea is there is a creature, a beast. Once again, this is very parallel to Revelation 13. There is a beast. It has 12 wings and 3 heads. The beast, once again, in this case, is an eagle. And the eagle represents what nation?
Rome,
right? Rome walked around with eagles. All of the legions, the signa for the legion, the standards had a silver eagle on it. So in this case, it is quite explicitly an eagle and quite explicitly Rome. 12 emperors all the way up into Domitian. And then focusing on the Flavian dynasty, this book was probably written in the 90s. So this would be very close to when Revelation was written. If you are like some people and think Revelation was written in the 60s, the author of, like me, the author could have totally read Revelation before he wrote this. Whoever he is, he's not actually Ezra. Even though it is written that way. If it's in the 90s, then if Revelation was written then and this was written in the 90s, maybe they're just completely independent. But the reason why I give you this, all right, is this is the kind of imagery that Jews would use to talk about things. And so here's another example where they use a beast. And believe it or not, after this beast, which is quite clearly Rome and specifically through Domitian, another beast arrives. This one is a lion. In Ezra, the lion, of course, would be Jewish lion would be Messiah, right? And so Ezra's a little different than that, but I leave that for you. What we're going to be paying attention to, though, is this family tree that's up here at the top. Okay, some of this material we went through last time, we'll go through the first parts pretty quickly. First bit's talk about Antipater, all right? We need to establish, all right, and this is what I want to show, all right? In general background, it's really useful to know how the Herods fit in with Rome in general, all right? So regardless of Revelation in terms of New Testament and the history that's going on there, it's good to know this stuff. But what I specifically want to show you through this is the Herods are a good candidate, all right? A good candidate for the second beast. Not necessarily today try to prove that they are the second beast, but just a really good candidate, all right? I want to show you how much they love Rome and how much they are completely and utterly dependent on Rome, just like the second beast is dependent on the authority of the first beast in Revelation 13. So timeline-wise, if you go to the top of Herodians in Rome, all of these dates are B.C. And they are B.C. until the second page when the numbers stop going down and start going back up again. I didn't explicitly label that, but you guys are swift. I know you got it. The most important things to think about on this first part of the list, which, like I said, we will go through fairly quickly, is this. In the when we start here in the 140s, right, 140 years ish before Jesus is born, the Jews have just had their rebellion against Antiochus the Fourth Epiphanes. All right, Antiochus the Fourth Epiphanes, you might remember, is the one who came into the temple, sacrificed a pig on the altar, all right, defiling the temple, tried to force the Jews to leave the law and adopt Hellenism. Mattathias and his children, Judas Maccabeus being the most famous, they rebelled and eventually won independence. When you hear the Maccabean Revolt, this is referring to that. So, Maccabean, all right. There's another term, and this basically means the same thing. Hasmonean, all right. This Jewish family, who were priests but not of the line of Zadok, took over not only the kingship but ultimately also the priesthood. And they stayed the primary priest until the time of Herod. So that's the beginning. Now, what happens shortly after this, right, is you've got the Seleucid Empire over here and the Ptolemies in the Egypt. You might remember those guys. Over here in the way in the west is Rome. All right, Rome at this time is growing rapidly, crushing everything in its way as it ultimately goes east and further east. What you've got next that I want to point out is if you look at, I don't know, like 10 or so, 7, 8, 9, 10, 75 through 66 BC is the Third Mithridatic War, the Romans' Third Mithridatic War. They had to beat this country three different times. This is a war, as the Romans move west, this is a war with Pontus. Pontus is a nation just south of the Black Sea, north of all of these guys, all right? So why is this relevant to the Bible? Well, it's relevant to the Bible because the guy who ultimately finished this war was Pompey the Great. And Pompey the Great is over here whooping up on these guys, but ultimately gets called into the south. And so what happens is they're right about that same line, 65 through 64... All right, you've got a disagreement. All right, a very strong disagreement between two people, a guy named Aristobulus. We'll see that name again in a different person, and a guy named Hyrcanus. Hyrcanus and Aristobulus were both descendants of the Maccabeans. They were both descendants of the Hasmoneans. Well, Hyrcanus was high priest. There was a war. You've got two brothers. Aristobulus wanted to rule. Hyrcanus said no. They eventually appealed to Pompey. Pompey, who's right over here in Syria, says, you know what, I'm going to choose Aristobulus. There's lots of fighting and all sorts of fun things there. Ultimately, that whole time period kind of ends when Pompey just marches down in 63 BC down here and conquers Jerusalem. All right. As of that point, the Hasmoneans are no longer in charge. It's not that they're not around, but they're not really the powers in town. Rome is. All right. And especially, and this is why I have Syria here. All right. Syria is a major, important place for Rome. Okay. Judah, it can rebel and fall apart, and that's bad. All right. Syria is super important. And the reason why Syria is super important to Rome is that's the first place Parthia is going to come if they attack. So the Romans, this area is very important strategically for them. And what will often happen in the history of Judah is there's a relationship between Syria and Judah in the sense of, if there's not a strong Jewish leader, you know who's going to be in charge? Probably the guy from Syria. All right. If a Roman army needs to come in, it's probably going to come in from right here down to here. So Pompey comes in, basically settles things to a certain degree. Now, how does Herod come into all of this? If you look down pretty far, let's see. Ultimately, where is the first mention of Antipater? It's actually just, it's at that same line, okay? So in 65 to 64, the Romans side with Aristobulus over Hyrcanus. Hyrcanus, Antipater, and Herod leave for Petra. Now, Petra is not just a 90s Christian rock band, though it is a fabulous 90s Christian rock band. Petra's down here. Now, Petra's still visited today. Who's seen pictures of Petra? Right? It's
temple inside.
Carved into the stone. I'd love to go there. Fantastic place. So this would be Petra. And Petra would be like the seat, the capital of an Arabian kingdom that's down there. So Herod and his line, or really his father, Antipater, comes into the scene at this point. Antipater's an Idumean, all right, from down here. Antipater's friends with Hyrcanus, and they get kicked out. But that's, if you know, Rome comes into Judah and kicks you out, essentially, you'd think your life is over. And for the most part, that would be the case. However, Antipater, as is Herod, is really good at politics. Ultimately, what happens is Hyrcanus comes back in. Hyrcanus comes back in, which brings Antipater back in, Herod's father, and Antipater becomes friends with none other than Julius Caesar. Now, in terms of other important parts of Roman history, you've got in here the assassination of Julius Caesar. This comes at B.C. It's actually all the way on the second page, isn't it? Yeah, there you go. Thank you. First page down towards the bottom. So what ultimately happens? The first time the Herodian line ingratiates itself with Rome is when Julius Caesar is further south down here dealing with a revolt, dealing with some things in Egypt. Antipater, Herod's father, comes down and helps him, gives him some troops. As a result, Antipater becomes a Roman citizen. And then, ergo, Herod would be a Roman citizen, Antipas would be a Roman citizen, and so forth, those that we actually see within the context of the New Testament. Now let's jump back to 51, all right? Let's get to 51 and then we'll go through the sequence. In 51, Cleopatra VII begins her rule, all right? I think we mentioned her last time. This would be the famous Cleopatra. There are many Cleopatras, but this is the famous one, the one with Mark Antony, the one that people make movies about, the supposedly beautiful ruler of Egypt. There's Aristobulus and Alexander. These are all children in the Hasmonean dynasty. Alexander, one of them, is beheaded by Scipio at Pompey's command. In 49, Caesar passes over the Rubicon. What's the cause of what does this cause? Just historically, Seneca gets really mad. Ultimately, this is the start of the end of the Roman Republic. Caesar crosses the Rubicon. Pompey is killed at Pompey's death. Antipater cultivates his friendship with Caesar, helps him in Egypt, and is given Roman citizenship. Whenever you see war, all right, in parentheses, that's a reference to Josephus' work, War of the Jews. And so if you want to read that there, you can find it. In 47, Caesar makes Antipater procurator of Judea and a Roman citizen. All right, and so Caesar is over in the east setting up the political arrangement. He has obviously not been assassinated yet. He's over in the east setting up the political arrangement, puts Antipater in charge. So this would be looking at your chart over there. This would be Herod the Great's father once again. Caesar makes Antipater procurator of Judea and a Roman citizen. Herod marries Doris. All right. Now, we will not pay much attention to all of Herod's wives. We'll only pay attention to two. One of them is Doris, because Doris is the mother of his first child. Okay? Now, that child's name is, and this is confusing, Antipater. All right? So when it says there on the very next line, Antipater stabilizes Judea, this is not Herod's son Antipater, because he would be zero. This would be his father Antipater. So Antipater as procurator, he makes Herod governor of Galilee, and Phasaelus governor of Jerusalem, be a brother of Herod. In 46, Herod is made the general of Coela Syria and Samaria by Sextus Caesar, a relation of Julius Caesar. And Coela Syria is here.
What position is Sextus Caesar? I've never heard of that.
I believe Sextus Caesar is running Syria at this time, if I recall correctly. Yeah. He wasn't a son of Jesus. No, he was not a son of Julius Caesar. He was a relation, yeah. And I don't know anything interesting that ever happened to him after this point. He does not play any sort of major role. As you know, Octavian, his adopted son, is who becomes emperor. Oh yeah. So now you've got Herod, right? Antipater and Herod are in charge of Judea simply because, all right, of their relationship to Julius Caesar, all right. And at this point, this relationship starts and grows and grows. In 45, Herod helps Caesar once again. Antipater is born, all right. So this would be his first son, is born to Herod and Doris. At this point, Caesar adopts Octavian, the future Augustus. And then on March 15th, the Ides of March, in 44, Caesar is murdered. All right. As a part of this civil war that happens, you've got Brutus and Cassius, whom you may be very familiar with from other things. Cassius and Brutus end up coming over here to the east. And so you've got Cassius in charge of Syria. And so what you find with the Herods, as we mentioned last time, is the Herods are really good, all right, at their relationship with Rome, right? They're friends with Caesar, but then he's dead. So they become friends with Cassius, all right, until he's dead. So they become friends with Mark Antony until he's dead. And so they become friends with Octavian, all right, until he's dead, and to all of his descendants of the throne. They're very, very good politicians. So in 43, Cassius takes over Syria, again, this time as a rebel. Herod supports Cassius, gets promoted, all right. Antipater, the father of Herod, is poisoned at this point. So now it's Herod and his brothers ultimately in charge over in the east in Judah. 42, Cassius and Brutus are defeated by Octavian and Mark Antony. All right, so Mark Antony was a general of Caesar's. Octavian, a adopted son of Caesar. They defeat Brutus and Cassius. Herod now switches sides. He bribes Antony. Hey, Antony, I can totally be your friend. Here's a great deal of money. And that happens. In 42, the very famous affair between Antony and Cleopatra begins. It is not over until they are both dead. At that point, Antony, he was bribed, after all, makes Herod and one of his brothers tetrarchs. In 40, Parthia comes in, takes over Syria. Herod has to ultimately leave, right? Because if Parthia comes over here and Rome loses this, they are not particularly well defended over here. So what ultimately happens at that point is Herod has to flee, and he flees to Rome, right? Because Rome's his buddy. He flees to Rome, and the Senate, all right, the Senate tells Herod, you're king of Judea, Now, Herod is not at this point actually king of Judea. Someone else is ruling in Judea because Parthia put somebody else in charge. But now for the next 3 years, Herod has to go in with Rome's help and win back Judah, which he does. And that's up to 37.
There's a very important economic motive behind all this too, isn't there? Because the port cities there in Syria, Judah, are the terminus of roads coming from the east.
Mm-hmm.
Silk, spices.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And
very, very valuable merchandise.
And these wars would affect that, but also a lot of just the everyday commerce would have just kept flowing anyway. So it doesn't really matter who ruled Syria. The merchants would still get through. But you're right. It would totally, in the middle of a war, things get affected. All right, large bodies of people roaming across the countryside to kill other large bodies of people. Yes. And so from 40 to 37, Herod is ousted. Herod and family are ousted because of the Parthians. And the Parthians put another Hasmonean in charge, but then Herod has to come back. At this time, Herod also divorces his first wife, Doris, and gets rid of Antipater. He's not murdered yet. That doesn't happen for a long time. But he gets rid of Doris and marries, and this is very important, he marries his second wife, Mariamne. Now, Mariamne is a Hasmonean. She is a descendant of Mattathias. Why is that important? It's really simple. If you're a Jew and you want to lead the Jews and you want to be king of the Jews, all right, it would be really smart for you to marry into that very famous and very influential and very powerful family, the Hasmoneans. And apparently she was beautiful, but Herod married her, all right? Herod married her. She was like 15, 16 whenever they got married. He, much older than that. They got married right there at the end of the revolt when Herod takes back over in 37. Alexander, who will not survive later, is born to Mariamne in 36. Herod's son, Aristobulus IV, is born. Now, if you look at your chart, Aristobulus IV is on there. All right. By the time you get to the New Testament, he's dead. However, his children are very important. And so that's why he's on there. And you can also see some of their mothers. This is not all the children of Herod, but you can see Mariamne. She's the Hasmonean. There's a Cleopatra. This is not the Cleopatra of Antony and Cleopatra. That would have got him killed. This is a different Cleopatra. And then another one named Malthus. Okay, moving on. In 31, Herod goes to Octavian, and this is because in 31, Octavian and Mark Antony get in a war. Octavian wins, so Herod once again has to switch allegiances. He goes to Octavian on Rhodes, which Chip just mentioned, goes to Octavian on Rhodes and basically says, look, I know I was faithful to your enemy, but I will be just as faithful to you now. And Octavian goes, okay, which from a political perspective was a smart move for Octavian because Herod really was faithful to him to the very end. In 29, Herod murders his second wife, Mariamne. At this point in 27, we have a breach of the law where Herod puts a non-Hasmonean, non-Zadokite as high priest. Octavian is proclaimed at this point Augustus, and no one calls him Octavian anymore. At this point, he's Augustus, and so you'll see that as we go through. Now, two things are very important in 22. One, Herod begins the building of the city of Caesarea Maritima. Caesarea Maritima being over here-ish, okay? Now, Caesarea Maritima. Caesarea named such because of his friendship with Caesar. Maritima, because it's by the sea. I was reading a biography of Herod. They made a very interesting point, which I totally did not know, that this was, when Herod built it, the largest port in the Mediterranean, even being larger than all of the Roman ports, which I thought was really super interesting. Anyway, so he builds that, and that might come up again later. Another very important part is... And there's a a reference here to Suetonius, Octavian had a habit of taking the children in of various subject rulers around the nation, around his empire. Part of those were the children of Herod. Almost all, maybe all, of Herod's male children and their children were all educated with the emperors in Rome. This is one reason why they're best buddies, because some of them were best buddies from childhood. And so Herod starts sending his children. Now the first two that he ends up sending, Alexander and Aristobulus, who are of the Hasmonean line, who are children of Mariamne, will both be murdered soon. But they are sent to Augustus, and they grow up with him. In 20, as you might know, the temple in Jerusalem was rebuilt by Herod. He spent a lot of money on it. In the year 14, he brings back Doris. He undivorces his wife Doris, which also brings back Antipater. In B.C. 7, Herod kills his sons Alexander and Aristobulus the Fourth because he thinks they are in league against him. Well, he did kill their mother, and so that's very possible. So Herod kills those sons, Alexander and Aristobulus, so you can mark off that guy that's on your family chain right there. All right? In roughly B.C. 4, Jesus was born. No one knows exactly when, but it was about then. It is also then that Herod dies. Now, when Herod, the king of Judah, dies, what happens?
Joseph and Mary come back from Egypt.
They do come back from Egypt. What happens in terms of the rule of Judah? This is the rule of the land of Israel. This is mentioned in the New Testament. It gets split, right? Now, if you look at your handy-dandy chart, Antipas, Archelaus, and Philip. All right? Not the first Philip, the second Philip in your chart. Yes, he had two sons named Philip, as we mentioned last time. All right? Those three, ultimately, they get the empire. Now, the way this actually works is when Herod dies, they all have to go to Rome to make sure it's okay with Augustus for them to go. So one thing that's, and be rulers. And so Herod has written a will. He wrote like five different wills, or six, because he kept killing his children, and so he had to change the will. The will is taken with the children and a delegation of Jews who basically say they don't want anything to do with the Herods at all, go to Rome, and Augustus puts essentially those three in charge. And that's how essentially you get what you get in the New Testament. And so remember the New Testament story, which Edward just mentioned. Herod the Great was the ruler of the Jews, the king of the Jews, when Jesus was born. Remember the murder of the people and of the children in Bethlehem. When he dies, Joseph comes back. All right, Joseph comes back, but he doesn't stay in Judah. Why does he not? All right. He hears that Archelaus is ruling in Judah. All right. What did Archelaus do? He actually, during Passover, just after he got his rule, all right, just after he got his rule, he actually killed a few thousand people during Passover. So he was a very wicked person. And so when you got in the New Testament where Joseph hears that Archelaus is ruling and is afraid and so doesn't want to be in his land and goes to Galilee, that's smart, because Archelaus was actually removed just a few years later because he really was a genuinely terrible person, as were many of them. Yes, sir.
One quick question. Eagle incident?
Mm-hmm. Oh, did I skip that? No.
That
this is
when the Romans hung emblems on temple gates.
This is when Herod put an eagle, which, Roman symbol, all right, when Herod put an eagle up in Jerusalem. This caused quite a stir. The Jews had major problems with pictures of people and animals going up within the city as a breach of the law. And so there was an incident where Herod put one up and some Jews went and hacked it to pieces, essentially. And so what naturally happened to those Jews? Herod is a maniac, and he hacked them to pieces as well. All right, we got 3 minutes. All right, and then we're going to pull this thing to an end. And once again, I didn't finish the list. Quick highlights. How do we want to say it this way? Look at your, I'll let you look at the list. Look at your family tree. What happened? Antipas, Philip, Archelaus, all growing up with the emperors of Rome. Archelaus didn't last long. Antipas did a really good job, or at least in Rome's eyes, he did a good job. Philip, he lived quite a while. Aristobulus, as you know, is already dead by this point. But his son Agrippa, who does show up in the New Testament, all right, reigns from 37 to 44. And then Agrippa II reigns from 48 to 66. And then there's the Jewish Rebellion. In the Jewish Rebellion, he doesn't reign. And the reason why he doesn't reign in the Jewish Rebellion is because the Herods always choose Rome over the Jews. And so what happened is Agrippa II left and then supported Vespasian in his war against the Jews. All right? He tried to get the Jews from rebelling, obviously. He didn't want to get kicked out himself. But he supported them. Who are some of these other names? Well, Herodias, you know from the New Testament, probably she divorced her husband Philip. This would be the Philip on the far left of your chart. To marry Antipas. And then, of course, who was the famous figure who said that's wrong? John the Baptist. And he died for it. That would be that Herodias. Now, Agrippa had two sisters, Berenice or Berenice and Drusilla. I just want to mention them for two reasons. One, Berenice, who also shows up when you see Agrippa in Acts, you see Berenice with him. That is his sister. All right. Berenice, in terms of being close to the Romans, Berenice becomes, during the Jewish revolt, the lover of Titus and is taken to Rome by Titus and only kicked out by Titus when the Romans said, you cannot keep this Jewish woman as your wife. And so she has to leave. So if you want to know how close were the Herods with the Caesars, they were very close. Or how about Drusilla? She also shows up, I think, once. She married as her second or third husband, I believe it was Felix, who shows up in Acts. And so how close was she? She was really close. And for those of you who have been around for our discussions, you will not guess how Drusilla died. She was killed at Pompeii by Mount Vesuvius. Through all of this, and I wish we had more time, and we can't spend forever. Through all of this, all right, the Herods are always pushing for Rome, all right? They're always pushing for Rome, consistently. Sure, when Caligula wanted to put a statue of himself up in the temple because he was a jerk, did the Herod, the Antipas at that point, try to talk him out of it? Yes, he did, because he knows that's going to start a revolt. Would he support the emperor? Yes, he would, all of the time, consistently, 100% of the time. They're on the side of Rome, even when they have to kill their own countrymen. If you're interested in more information about the Herods, this is a great biography. All right. It will take you a little while to read. It's not a small biography. But this is just about Herod the Great. All right. The worst of the Herods. Herod, the one who killed so many of his own children. It's a great biography. You want to come take a look at it, get a copy. Totally recommend it. Way too much information for us to discuss, obviously. So if you want to go take a look at this, all right. Josephus' War of the Jews, Josephus' Antiquity of the Jews, goes through all of this history. You'll see other things that I reference, Strabo, his geography, Suetonius' biography of the Caesars. There's some other references there you might find useful. Okay, at that point we have to stop, because we do need to spend a few minutes fellowshipping before we go over next door. If you have questions, please ask them at lunch. Not right now, because I went over badly last time, and I don't want to do that again this time. So I'll be available if you want to talk about any of this stuff. We can go through other pieces of the timeline. Next time, we will get back into pure Revelation chapter 13. All right. And if you want to discuss this second Esdras passage, totally open to that too. All right. So catch me during lunch or later. Okay. Thank you. It's a lot of history. I hope you found it useful. I hope. Okay. At the very least, you've got a list of a jumping off point of some other things you can read. Edward, will you pray for us, please?